Coming up on The Green from Delaware Public Media. Controversial changes to state corporate law designed to fend off an incorporation Dexit recently got a stamp of approval from Delaware Supreme Court.
We knew that it could have tremendous effects, legal and economic and budgetary. In Delaware, we got it wrong. We knew that getting it right would not necessarily be something that was verifiable immediately because we figured there would be a court challenge.
We talked to the bill's sponsor, State Senator Brian Townsend, this week. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. We also learn about a University of Delaware professor's work to help test AI's capabilities. And Arts Playlist previews the latest exhibition at the Biggs Museum of American Art. It's all next on The Green, where Delawareans get tuned into a first state of mind. But first, the news from NPR. Welcome to this week's edition of The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. Delaware's Supreme Court recently upheld a law passed by the state's General Assembly last year designed to keep companies from leaving the state to incorporate elsewhere, a trend dubbed Dexit. The state faced increasing scrutiny for its corporate rules and oversight since 2024 after the Court of Chancery nixed a $54 billion compensation package for Elon Musk, and Musk in turn pulled both Tesla and SpaceX from the state. Last spring, State Senator Brian Townsend sponsored Delaware's response, Senate Bill 21, and he says he was keenly aware of the eyes on Delaware during debate over this bill.
It was a very stressful, very high-stakes few months of trying to ensure that our laws are very clearly striking the proper balance. And we knew that it could have tremendous effects, legal and economic and budgetary. In Delaware, we got it wrong. We knew that getting it right would not necessarily be something that was verifiable immediately because we figured there would be a court challenge.
And Townsend was right. A challenge to the new law came from a Clearway Energy stockholder last spring who argued SB 21 violated the state's constitution. The Court of Chancery asked the state's highest court to weigh in, and now it has, siding with the General Assembly and upholding SB 21. This week on The Green, Townsend reflects on SB 21 and where the state stands almost a year later with Delaware Public Media state politics reporter Benta Boutier.
Thanks for speaking with me today, Senator Townsend. So we know Delaware Supreme Court upheld a law that you worked on last year with the General Assembly. There were a lot of eyes on this case as Delaware is where more than 60% of Fortune 500 companies choose to incorporate. What was it like to work on that?
And I remember very early on in the SB 21 process, before SB 21, I think, even had a number assigned to it. It might have been as we were drafting it. I got an email from an old friend who I have not talked to much over the past, that time, 21 years, I guess it was. We had not talked many times over that, but we had known each other for about 22 years. He's an attorney out in California. And he emailed me as this was all kind of launching and as the tensions were absolutely raging. And he said, "Hey, Brian, I don't know what's going on out there in Delaware, but I just want to let you know that my phone out here in California is ringing off the hook with certain kinds of companies that are all asking me of whether or not they should continue to be in Delaware or should start their business in Delaware." He said, "Something has happened." And I think that's one of the key things that had happened here with regard to SB 21, what led to SB 21, is that it felt like for the first time in essentially forever, where there was this wider spread sentiment of perhaps Delaware is not the place to be.
So the Court of Chancery took this up, but asked the Delaware Supreme Court to weigh in. Is that unusual?
Well, there are times when there are questions of law where it makes the most sense to have that question of law be adjudicated as quickly as possible, not only because of the broader implications for entities throughout the world, but also for the litigants themselves right there in the dispute. It's really helpful to have questions of law answered quickly. And this is a situation where you had both the impact on the litigation itself, as well as the impact of uncertainty all around the world, that if there wasn't clarity on this issue, it would affect a whole lot of things all over the world. And so it is not unusual, certainly not unprecedented and not unusual for there to be this process where the Court of Chancery, then up to the Supreme Court, brings clarity as to the legality, whether it's constitutional or otherwise, with regard to a pending issue.
And it sounds like you think the General Assembly's action last year has been mischaracterized as a response to Elon Musk's leaving Delaware. What did it mean for such a high-profile person to take action?
I think very unfortunately, our governor mentioned his name very early on in the process in a way that caused people to think that that's what was on the governor's mind anyway. And I can't speak to that, but I can say that legislators were very aware this had nothing to do with any specific individual. I guess what I'd say is that I think it was pretty opportunistic of Elon Musk to, he was frustrated with Delaware for a variety of reasons. And I think there's a lot of things that he had done, or at least certain issues in the cases that he was involved in, where the court's rulings that were not in his favor made tremendous sense. I can't speak for him at all, but my sense is that he would advocate that there shouldn't be the kind of guardrails that Delaware is known for. And what the misconception of Senate Bill 21 was, this idea that we were like taking away the guardrails in a way that he wanted. And that wasn't true at all. It was that we were reaffirming the guardrails, but in a different mechanism of statute rather than having them just be in the case law that the judges have decided. But also, it wasn't just him. I mean, there were several cases involved that led to this. There were several different cases over the years that had nothing to do with Elon Musk that resulted in this. So it wasn't just one thing. It wasn't just one business. It was a combination of a few things that had resulted in the need for clarity in Delaware law. But I think basically, just like wildfires do, there's a spark that just kind of started raging. And thankfully, I believe we were able to take care of it. A lot of different segments of the Delaware ecosystem came together quickly. A key part of the system, the judiciary, then played its role and culminated in the Supreme Court opinion confirming the constitutionality of Senate Bill 21.
Delaware's new rules set statutory safe harbors for some of these corporate transactions, defining a controlling shareholder within a company as someone who owns at least half of a company's shares or a third of shares plus managerial control. It reduces the amount of scrutiny between business leaders and their companies when there's conflict of interest. How does this better balance corporate law for Delaware?
Delaware's business friendliness when it comes to the franchise and our system of corporate law is very much the idea that you've got to be able to strike the right balance between investors' rights and protections when they're the ones owning the business. They're the investors. They're the ones, the stockholders. They own the business. It's their business. But you also need the business to be able to run practically and effectively. And so in order to do that, you've got to give management and directors and officers, you have to give them the tools to be able to run the business and take proper risks to achieve success of the business. And so it's a balance. It's a constant balance between investor rights and protections and officer and director flexibility and duties. And not having officers and directors be second-guessed when they make the best decision they can make, when they educate themselves as to the business risks. They look at it, they consider it, they take the right risk to try and earn results for the owners of the company. And if it goes wrong, you can't like penalize them at the end of the day. You shouldn't penalize them at the end of the day. If they inform themselves and they were trying to do their best for the stockholders, not themselves. That's what business friendly means for Delaware. I think there are a lot of people who don't understand that, including some people who criticize Delaware heavily from within Delaware, don't understand what that is about. I mean, Delaware corporate law is not about giving tax breaks to companies. It's not about blessing like environmental pollution or, you know, businesses need to operate responsibly in our society. Delaware corporate law is not about blessing any of those ills. Delaware corporate law is about basically saying, hey, you want to own a business? You want to be an investor or a stockholder? Please, like we want people to invest in businesses and you're going to have certain protections. But the people who run the business also have to be able to do their jobs. And so it's all about striking that right balance. It's not about blessing any negative societal outcome. So that's what's meant by business friendly in Delaware when it comes to the Delaware corporate law.
You've said the judiciary, Court of Chancery, is the largest component to Delaware's reputation for corporate law, deciding cases fairly and predictably. Where does your role as a legislator start, as you did step in last year?
It means being prepared to act quickly if necessary, but certainly act predictably overall, year in and year out. I think that part of what has made Delaware successful, to be very, very clear, that I think the judiciary is the driving force of it. I think the industry that exists in Delaware to also be available to adjudicate these disputes is critical. But the legislature each year is involved in updating the laws, and we need to do so sort of apolitically with clarity and stability and predictability. I mean, that's what makes this industry special. It shouldn't change, frankly, much at all with whatever party is in power, whatever people are in specific offices. It really needs to be stable in delivering not only the balanced law in the books, not only the statute or the case law the courts decide, also the ecosystem is very important. You have to have a well-functioning judiciary that's funded with the resources to do the work that it needs to do. We have to have support from the Secretary of State's office to make sure they continue to be able to provide the amazing services that have existed for many, many years in the Secretary of State's office for the broader world of incorporation. So it's both budgetary from the legislative perspective, you have to invest in the system, and then it's statutory in terms of updating the laws and showing the world that we are going to consistently be updating our laws to make sure they are the most modern and the most properly flexible for what people need out there when they're making a decision as to where to incorporate.
Other states have stepped in to update corporate laws and compete with Delaware to attract these corporations. Where do you think we'd be without Senate Bill 21?
Well, there's no way to quantify that. I think that if we had not shown the broader world that we continue to have the capacity and the commitment to step up, and that it would have been a major hit to our reputation. And I think it would have led very clearly to other jurisdictions gaining ground on us in terms of being the place where investors and businesses want to go and have their disputes be settled. So there's no way to know with certainty how quickly, you know, a greater exodus would have occurred. And there's no way to know with certainty that there won't, you know, that there won't be a changing landscape in the coming years. And now I think it's accurate to say that there are at least two jurisdictions that are taking this very seriously and are going to try much more actively, much more thoroughly to compete with us. So the chapter of SB 21, you know, the Supreme Court ruling, the chapter in Delaware's corporate law history might be written, but the book's not fully written. It never will be. I mean, it'll always be another chapter added to it. We've got to stay on top of the on top of our game to continue to be the place where all sides want to be. But there's no way to quantify how bad it would have gotten. So this has been a long road the past 13 months and a week, give or take. It's been a long road, but at least on the legal side of it, there's a lot of more finality now and clarity. And now it's just a matter of Delaware and the judiciary in particular continuing to deliver results every week, every month, every year moving forward to show the world that, you know, if you have a legal dispute in these complicated matters of fiduciary duty or contract law, that Delaware is a place that you want to be. Thankfully, we remain on target for that.
Governor Meyer released a statement last week citing business stats for Delaware. The number of incorporated entities in Delaware grew from 2.1 million in 2024 to 2.2 million in 2025, and net growth for incorporation in Delaware for 2025 outpaced the growth from 2024 in the same time period. How does this read to you? Does this sound promising?
And I think it's very important not to rely too much on present statistics either, frankly, because number one, there's a huge difference between the number of alternative entities that are here versus the number of C-corps that are here. And we've seen it's possible for a very small number of individuals to try and frighten the broader market. And we can't cater to just one or two individuals at all. It's got to be having fidelity to core legal principles that made Delaware the place everyone really wants to be overall, and just continue to show that that is the best way to strike the proper balance.
It sounds like you take this as some of the dust settling with Senate Bill 21. I'm wondering where you see things going from here.
We just have to be very careful that people from across the world see our system of law as predictable and stable and consistent. And that can change there's a whole lot of new legislators the past few years. There's been a tremendous turnover in the legislature. And that could be an amazing thing in so many different ways. And not at all should we be saying that there should not be the opportunity for questions and for engagement in the area of Delaware corporate law. And we've got to stay committed to that tried and true process of understanding these issues and always been committee hearings. There's always been open discussion and debate. It takes hard work every week, every month, every year, and let's not confuse that. I mean, it absolutely continues to be hard-earned. It really is a very, very meritorious system that we can't take for granted, and we've got to continue to earn our reputation every single day.
Thanks to State Senator Brian Townsend and our Benta Boutier for joining us on The Green this week. And stay with us. The Green continues with more on a University of Delaware professor's work to help test AI's capabilities. That's next on The Green, here on Delaware Public Media. Welcome back to The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. A University of Delaware professor is part of a team that's come up with a test for artificial intelligence programs. Humanity's Last Exam tests how fast AI capabilities are advancing. The exam was created by experts from around the world to figure out if AI programs can figure out solutions independently. Delaware Public Media's Joey Rosari recently spoke with Humanity's Last Exam contributor Manuel Schottdorf, a neuroscientist in the University of Delaware's Department of Psychological and Brain Sciences, about this AI test.
You have come up with essentially a test for AI, Humanity's Last Exam. What is it exactly?
First, it's a collaborative project from many, many people who contributed to this effort, trying to come up with a really challenging test to see how good AI systems actually are in reasoning and critical thinking and come up with a solution to challenging tasks. I really played a small role in this. It was a crowdsourced catalog, in the end, 2,500 questions that cover essentially all domains of science, philosophy, humanities, art history, music. And this body of questions is constructed so that it would be difficult to find the answer to these questions. We kept the answers secret, just ask the AIs the questions and see how good they really are in figuring out the answers. It's called Humanity's Last Exam because it alludes to this being the current frontier of human knowledge, understanding the horizon of what is known to us as a species.
When this came about, Humanity's Last Exam, was this something that was brought to you? You were just thinking, you know, let's test AI. I mean, how did that come about?
I actually came to this kind of effort through an ad that I saw online where people were looking for these questions. So this is not an effort that started UD. It was organized by the Center for AI Safety. And they just reached out to the community. Like, do you have a background in math, in physics, in anything that's kind of considered challenging? And do you have a few good ideas for hard puzzles or hard questions? And then the way it worked is, you know, there's a system. We just write down questions that we think are good. And then they were evaluated by our peers. So other folks, you know, like myself, looked at other people's questions and we thought about, can we answer these? Is the solution correct? Is there any chance you could cheat at this test? And then the questions were ranked, they were evaluated, and then the top ranking questions made it into the final version of the exam. Yeah, that context, like, what do I know about art history, right? Like, I wouldn't be qualified to ask a good question, or would I be qualified to judge whether one is actually solvable? But my own background is in physics. My degree is in physics. I used to do a lot of theoretical physics work. So I'm much better in mathematics and geometry and topology, problems of that nature. So I'm much more qualified in coming up with good questions in these domains and assessing whether they can be solved or not.
What did you find out from Humanity's Last Exam? Like, what was AI able to correctly answer? What did it struggle with, if you can share with us?
So initially, most of the big large language models, Gemini and Claude and ChatGPT, did not perform particularly well on these challenging questions. But they have made enormous progress over the last few years and now regularly score, you know, 30, 40, 50% correct on these challenging questions. Now, that comes with an asterisk, and that is that now that this set of questions is publicly available, the answers are publicly available too. So there is a contamination problem that if these machines have gobbled up the answers too, then it doesn't really test their reasoning skills anymore. So it is a moving goalpost situation. Like, The challenge is to continue to collect good questions to be sure that we actually test reasoning abilities and not just their abilities to recall information that they have seen somewhere else. So whenever we chat about these kind of things with people, we try to not make the answers to the questions easily available. But there's so many and you can't be certain. And so part of this massive improvement over the last year, year and a half, could be associated with leakage of this testing data out into the domain of material that is available to these machines when they learn.
So essentially, it's kind of like maybe what a professor might have to go through when they do their studies, right? It's just because if you have the same exam, yep, at some point, it's going to go around, and then 2 or 3 years later, everybody's going to ace it. Yes. So it's the same thing here.
Yes, the student wants. It's exactly that system. Like, you can only use a question once. And once the solution is out there, the students will know, they will practice it really well, and then it doesn't really test their abilities and skills anymore. And it's the same situation here. It's just that the questions have a slightly different quality to them. But the underlying philosophy, the problem is exactly the same.
Now, with a lot of the humanities last exam, is this something that, say, a regular person will be able to do it? Or is it just one of those things where, like you were saying, it's particular studies, like if somebody can do the math and science part, if that's their expertise. So is that basically how we can look at it here from just a regular person's point of view?
I don't think there's a single human being who could solve all of these questions at the moment. They're all over the place, right? As I said, from art history to mathematics. That's a very broad range, and very few people are trained in depth in all of these different domains. That said, in a particular field, say physics or mathematics, I think anybody who went to school and studied this for a couple of years could probably solve these problems. They're usually on the level of a graduate student, so they are a bit more challenging, but an advanced undergraduate student or a graduate student should be able to solve these questions. It might take them a little while, but they should be able to reason their way to an answer. So they're not outrageously difficult. It's not like, the top 1% of all faculty on this planet can solve this. They're challenging, but not outrageously so. The challenge is all these questions touching on so many different domains of knowledge. That is what's where the name comes in, humanity's last exam. It's not the mathematician's last exam.
Did, when you tested different AI programs, was anyone particularly better at it, or is it just like with people, the certain ones are better than at certain things?
It's difficult to see patterns, and they also change so rapidly. As I'm sure you have noticed too, when you use these systems, they continue to learn, they continue to evolve. It's a system that changes its rules so quickly that it's very difficult to make hard statements. It's certainly true that overall they have made enormous improvements, and it's generally impressive where they have arrived at the moment.
Let's say a program does well on the exam, nails it, and what should we take from that? As people,
it's a good question. I think the only thing that actually demonstrates it's good in solving hard questions. What all of these models don't have is the same sense of physicality that we do. For example, when we use natural language, for us it's just a vehicle to communicate thought. And when I talk about the World Cup happening here pretty soon, the World Cup isn't just a word. Like, you associate a specific event with it, specific teams, events that will unfold. The word World Cup is just a sound, but it is anchored in the reality of our existence, our social structures, the stuff that we do with one another. And whether you say World Cup or use the same word in any other language, it's anchored to the reality of that event. When large language models learn structure of the world, they don't anchor it in real physical experiences. It's just statistical relationships between words. They might notice that the word World Cup occurs in certain contexts. For example, the names of players that are involved, or the names of certain teams or certain countries. But nothing of this has the tangibility that it would have to a human mind. And when we learn about the world, we learn about it very, very differently. When we are kids or students, we don't gobble up millions of hours of videos and millions of books to understand how language works. We experience the world in a very real sense, and then we use language to communicate our understanding of the world after the fact. And that is something that is just quite different between modern AI and how we learn. And that is something that Humanities Last Exam and many of these tests just can't test effectively because these machines are language-based. So we can only use language as a proxy. They will answer, and they're good in certain knowledge organizing tasks. But I don't think there's any actual understanding of what a World Cup is in these computational processes.
With AI, there's always a debate. People think it's good. People don't think it's good. There's arguments on both sides, and good arguments from both sides. From this exam and what we know, can it be trusted, AI, and how should we as people approach using it?
Well, that's at least an easy question, right? You shouldn't trust it blindly. But it certainly is a useful tool. And like most questions in the real world, there are all these shades of gray. It isn't universally bad. It isn't universally good, but it's certainly very useful. It makes some of our lives easier. It makes certain jobs easier, but it should be used with caution. It's just another tool in the toolbox, as the pocket calculator used to be. You know, it makes our lives a little bit easier as long as we use it with care. Like here at university, we use it too. It's a good teaching aid sometimes to make sure that our exams are solvable. We teach our students that they can, you know, use it for practicing, you know, ask the AI questions, see what they think about it. It can also be dangerous. You don't want to outsource all of your homework assignments to AI or you won't learn anything. So somewhere in this middle ground, there's real world use for them. And I think they will improve the human condition by and large, just like the pocket calculator.
So essentially the best way to look at it for it to be helpful is as a tool, not a crutch.
That's right.
Anything else you want to add about the Humanities Last Exam, specifically here with the AI?
The one thing I really want to stress is that this isn't my work alone. I'm just one of a very large group of people who have contributed to this effort. This is part of the fun. We're all part of a collaborative enterprise out of hundreds of scientists who have contributed to this effort. Some of them were students too, some of them postdocs, some of them faculty, and all of them have contributed their unique expertise to the frontier of human knowledge. And the data set is publicly available. If some of the listeners want to just, you know, check it out, you can just register and look at the question. And it's a heartwarming experience. It's very rare that you would see so much expertise at the same spot. Like the scope of human knowledge that is currently available is heartwarming. It's cool to see that how many people have spent hours of their lives thinking about something deeply and profoundly and caring about it in depth and then bringing that to paper. It's something that impresses me and brings a warm feeling to my heart.
And in the end, this will be an ongoing process as more AI programs right. become available and more questions. You have to come up with more questions to test them.
Folks can contribute to this. Some of the folks who listen to your radio show too, you can register, submit new questions, and they will be ranked by others. And maybe they make the cut for the next round or the next release of Humanities Last Exam and the subsequent versions thereof.
And where can they submit those questions?
Yep, they can.
Where?
There's just a web form. You can Google it, you register, you can do that with your Gmail account, and you submit questions. You need the question, the answer, and then first check is, can the AIs answer it? If they already can, then it's not a good question. So first selection is, can they answer it? If they can't, then the question has made level two, and then it's going to be evaluated by humans, other people of the evaluation committee, other folks have submitted questions, and they will rank the question on whether it's suitable to be used in this, you know, available body of future questions.
Thanks to University of Delaware neuroscientist Manuel Schottdorf and our Joey Rosari for joining us on The Green this week. And we wrap up The Green next with Arts Playlist and a visit to the Biggs Museum in Dover to learn more about their latest exhibition. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media. Thanks for spending time with us on The Green this week. I'm Tom Byrne. American artist Elizabeth Catlett spent much of her career as an expatriate. While beloved by artists for her captivating portrayals of black women, she was also marginalized by academia and, for a time, even her own government. Now the works of this compelling, politically aware artist are on display at the Biggs Museum of American Art in Dover. And in this edition of Arts Playlist, Delaware Public Media's Martin Matheny is joined by Biggs Curator of American Art, Laura Fravel, to learn more about Elizabeth Catlett.
Who was Elizabeth Catlett?
Elizabeth Catlett is kind of a titan in American art. She's one of the best known artists of the 20th century and a pioneering black woman, too, in her field. She started out in the 1930s. That's really when she first decided she wanted to be an artist. She was originally hoping to go to Carnegie Tech, now Carnegie Mellon University, but was denied entrance due to her race. She then entered Howard University, an HBCU, and the first HBCU that had its own dedicated art department. That was the first time that she saw an African-American artist and realized that this is a career path that she wanted for herself and could pursue. Unfortunately, had a family that supported her in that and encouraged her in that. From there, she went to the University of Iowa. And why the University of Iowa, you might ask? Because that is where Grant Wood was. And he was one of the most famous artists in the country at the time. And she thought, if I'm going to do this, I need to do it in the best way possible. He was a wonderful mentor to her and encouraged her to focus on something she knew best. And for him, as an American Regionalist painter, that was cornfields, that was the Midwest, that was landscapes. You might know his work from things like American Gothic, that painting of the farmer and his daughter with the pitchfork. But for Catlett, that becomes the lives of black women in this country, that these are people who surrounded her in life. These are strong, proud women who are almost unrepresented in the art of her time. And she wanted to capture their joys and their sorrows.
And then she spent some time in Mexico as well.
She did. She went there in 1946 for a fellowship in printmaking. Up to that point, she'd mostly been focusing on sculpture and thought that was her preferred medium, kind of took this little detour and fell in love with it. Also fell in love at the printmaking workshop, married Francisco Pancho Mora, who was her husband. And this was at the Teatro de Gráfica Popular. This is a printmaking workshop that also has an activist political component. And that is where she mastered things like lino cuts. And prints lend themselves to political imagery because you can make a lot of them relatively inexpensively and make many, many copies of them to distribute. She had always been an activist to some extent. At one point in her life, she even protested on the steps of the Supreme Court with a noose around her neck to protest lynching. Briefly, when she was teaching in New Orleans, she organized the first trip of African-American students to the New Orleans Museum of Art. So she's always trying to push the envelope to advocate for those who are underrepresented. But with this new tool of printmaking, it really expanded in Mexico. And that came at great personal cost in many ways. In the 1950s, she was arrested at a Mexican rail workers' strike for being a foreign agitator. And then to avoid further arrests and deportation, she became a Mexican citizen in 1962. That same year, the U.S. government labeled her an undesirable alien, and claiming that the printmaking workshop was a communist front, it barred Catlett and all the other artists associated with the workshop from entering the U.S. And though for decades, she couldn't come back to the places that she grew up. In 1971, she finally got a visa to return to attend her own opening at the Studio Museum in Harlem. And then finally, her American citizenship was reinstated in 2002. So a long struggle to keep that connection to her home going. And during that time, she made Mexico City her home.
You mentioned she started with sculpture and then shifted her focus to printmaking. How would you describe her works in both of those media?
Yes, I should say, I said shifted, but I think she kept a love for both of them throughout her life. Her work in sculpture ranges from carved wood to bronze. Some of it does focus more representationally on the lives of black women. Some of it is much more abstract. We have a piece in our exhibition now called Magic Mask that looks almost like a very smoothed out African mask, something that was left in a riverbed for a while, that's got these lovely curves and wonderful angles as you walk around it. Her work in printmaking ranges again from the very detailed and representational to the more abstract, often focusing on the lives of underrepresented people, whether that is black women or Mexican laborers. but also very colorful. And that's something that I like in our show, too, is these vibrant tones that come through, whether it's in this piece of all these women dancing at a party, or there's a piece, right when you first rock on the show, called There's a Woman of Every Color, that on the side has, I think, every color in her palette going down of the same image repeated over and over. And that's something wonderful about printmaking, is that you can play with series and repetition even within a single piece. For her life, one thing we haven't touched on yet is themes of motherhood in her work, that she, many of her children, grandchildren, then took up artistic careers themselves in some form, including one of her granddaughters, Amora, was a winner on America's Next Top Model and now a photographer.
How did this exhibition come about?
This exhibition has been traveling for a little while, and then through serendipity, the dates for one of their openings lined up with the dates on our calendar, but I knew it would be interesting. And I liked this focus on her work in particular because this entire exhibition is from the personal collection of Samela Lewis. And Samela Lewis was a student of Catlett's in the 1940s and stayed her lifelong friend. So I think has a unique perspective on her work. Samela Lewis is an artist herself, but also was the first Black woman in the country to get her doctorate in art history. She was pioneering in that field and really wrote some of the first books on African-American art in this country, including the first major monograph on Catlett's work. So it is a perspective on this great artist that I don't think we've seen that much. The show also includes a few pieces by Samela Lewis herself and then some by Maura, Catlett's husband.
You gave us kind of a sketch of Elizabeth Catlett's life and career, and it seems to me that there's this continuous through line of being marginalized and even rejected in America by academia, and as you mentioned, even by her own government. What did it take to get this American artist at least a start on the recognition that she deserves?
Yes, well, I talked about from that larger, more bureaucratic perspective, that type of rejection or the lines that are drawn. I don't want to make it seem like she was unknown in her own time. She was absolutely celebrated, had solo shows in the U.S., even though she was not able to travel to them, that the work itself was so strong that that carried her message for her. And I think some of that was her early investment in as many training opportunities as possible. And later she credited that to part of her success, is that she had that technical expertise that she could convey the message she had in her head effectively. When she taught herself, she would encourage her students to, again, invest in those technical studies. Even if you're taking a class that you don't think applies to what you want to do, you're always learning and refining your own tools to express yourself.
Can you talk a little bit about her influence as a teacher and some of the students that she worked with?
Dr. Samela Lewis, I think, is the best example of that. And I love that in our show, we can talk a bit about their relationship. And in the book that Lewis wrote, she included an entire section of Catlett's advice while she was teaching, where she just took down word for word these snippets. And in our exhibition, the final gallery, we've made a more interactive space. And we've actually let our visitors add the best advice they've been given to this communal wall and pass that on too. And I love seeing that develop too, not just for art students, but members of our community, of what has stuck with them through life and helped to guide them.
Are there particular messages from that communal wall that have stuck with you personally?
It is still developing, and there are a few that resonate with me. A lot of them deal with perseverance, of knowing what you want to do and where you want to go and continuing with that even if nobody believes in you in that moment. Some of them have to do with the power of art, even if you're not an artist, just spending time in a space like a museum or creating something can take you out of your own head and take a weight off of you, and how that's been impactful to people.
In a larger sense, one of the things that struck me about her career is the time, especially sort of the early years that she was in Mexico City, and some of the other great luminaries that she was acquainted with, that she was sharing ideas with, Diego Rivera, Frida Kahlo. Talk a little bit, if you will, about just sort of the larger sense of that scene at that time and how it might have influenced her.
Yes. Well, she went for this fellowship knowing a bit about what she was stepping into. At that point, she had studied Diego Rivera in school. The Mexican muralist movement was well underway. She'd briefly worked with the Work Progress Administration in the U.S., but I don't think she expected to be transformed in the way that she was. And many of the printmakers involved with this workshop were also themselves muralist painters in the community. That was another way to get the message out or to work with the community. And so many people in that circle, I think, helped her figure out how to expand her own message in her printmaking.
I may be taking a step too far. I may be getting way ahead of my skis on this, but I see the connection between muralists and printmakers, and both of those being art that is maybe designed to be super accessible to the general public, art that meets people where they are. And then I also note that Elizabeth Catlett was a WPA artist at one point in her career as well, and sort of that same connection of putting art where people are. And I wonder if that's a through line that we can kind of draw through her career.
Oh, absolutely. And she often spoke about putting art in service of the people, that it wasn't just something for her personally to do to express herself, but it had a purpose as well in the wider world. And that was, I think, a thoughtful approach into what she decided to put out.
Finally, what can we learn today? And we're just about 14 years after Elizabeth Catlett's death. She had an incredibly long life and career. What can we learn today from her art and from the way she lived her life?
Well, I think her work continues to resonate, to echo through the generations. But for the wider world, I've, through this exhibition, met so many teachers locally who show Catlett's work in their class, but have never been able to show their students this work in person before, which I think is unique about the Biggs, that we are here on the Delmarva Peninsula, the only museum really serving this community. And I'm thinking in particular about a college professor who teaches a course on Black art, and then a elementary middle school teacher who showed an image of Catlett's work in her class and then was here with her class for another event and got sidetracked going through the show because they knew these images. So I think there's a familiarity there, but more people are starting to connect her name with it as well, that you might know the images even if you don't know her name yet.
Laura Favell, thank you so much for your time, and best of luck with this exhibition.
Thank you so much.
Thanks to Biggs Curator of American Art, Laura Favell, for joining our Martin Matheny on this edition of Arts Playlist. The art of Elizabeth Catlett from the collection of Samela Lewis is on display at the Biggs Museum through June 22nd. And we've reached the finish line for this edition of The Green. The stories and interviews you've heard are online right now at DelawarePublic.org. Just head to The Green's page on our website. You can also sign up for our weekly newsletter there by clicking Newsletters at the top of the page. And remember, The Green is also available via podcast at our website, as well as Apple Podcasts, YouTube, and the NPR and Delaware Public Media apps. We'd also like to hear from you. Give us your feedback and story ideas on our Facebook page or by emailing us at thegreen@delawarepublic.org. Thanks to all those who helped make this week's show possible, Delaware Public Media's Bento Boutier, Joey Rosari, and Martin Matheny. For all of them and the rest of the staff here at Delaware Public Media, I'm Tom Byrne saying thanks for joining us this week. And we'll see you again next week on The Green, where Delawareans get tuned into A First State of Mind.